Good morning. It's good to be back in the body with you all. Even if
you're out of body, you can't tell.
Something like that. But anyway, it's been a long week. Yeah. A number of you have traveled some miles this week. And either in fact or in figure. And so it's good to gather once again. Let's get this plugged in. Mr. Kurt's still out today with a few of the lingering side effects. And so we're Zooming him, or he's Zooming us or something like that. So let me share with him. The last time we were studying Isaiah, we were in chapter 27, and we didn't quite get done with chapter 27, and so I bring to your attention once again that this particular chapter was assessed by Alec as being as fascinating a piece of mosaic as anything that Isaiah did. It starts out, you may remember, with two in that day oracles, one concerning Leviathan and the other concerning the vineyard of red wine. And we read through and are down toward the end of the chapter, and we'll look at the last two verses in particular, which bracket the chapter with a second pair of in that day oracles. So verse 12 says, "And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall beat off from the channel of the river unto the stream of Egypt, and ye shall be gathered one by one, O ye children of Israel." Already we need an alternative translation there, that beat off from the channel expression probably doesn't communicate to you directly any more than it did to me. The ESV has, "In that day, from the river Euphrates to the brook of Egypt, the Lord will thresh out the grain, and you will be gleaned one by one, O ye people of Israel." So the geographic description there basically is a description of the land of Israel at its fullest extent, as big as it got under Solomon. So it's a way of describing the full extent of the land, and it's a picture of God gathering in the faithful of the children of Israel. The second section, verse 13, goes like this, "And it shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come which were ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and the outcast in the land of Egypt, and shall worship the Lord in the holy mount at Jerusalem." So while verse 12 delineates the extent of the kingdom of Israel, this seems to go beyond and be looking at the future ingathering of Gentiles that will come to Zion to worship. So we've seen already in Isaiah a couple different times where he portrays the time whenever there shall be, believe it or not, an incoming of the Gentiles to worship in Mount Zion. And so that seems to be the change in focus between these verses. The first one being specifically limited geographically to the area the Jewish nation once possessed, and then the second one going beyond that. We have a reference here to "the great trumpet shall be blown." Now, trumpets are used throughout the Bible to denote things. They're used to make proclamations. There was a trumpet blown on the Day of Atonement. And here we have the great trumpet. The trumpet shall sound. Perhaps you remember the line from the Messiah about the trumpet. A kind of an interesting range of scriptures that make some reference to trumpets. In Corinthians 15, which we've already read some from this morning in our devotional, Paul says, "Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet," the last trump, "for the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed." So the last trump is how Paul refers to it. Isaiah speaks of the great trumpet. In 1 Thessalonians 4, Paul says, "For this we say unto you by the word of the Lord, that we which are alive and remain unto the coming of the Lord shall not prevent," that is, shall not precede, "them which are asleep. For the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet of God," or the trump of God, "and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so shall we ever be with the Lord." Okay. So here again we have this reference to the trumpet of God. In Matthew 24, Jesus says, "And he shall send his angels with the great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other." Now, if you read that verse in its context, it sounds as though Jesus is using the imagery of trumpets to speak not of specifically the last trumpet, but metaphorically of the proclaiming of the gospel by his messengers or angels. We see in Revelation a number of references to trumpets. John thinks there's a, it's as though a trumpet were speaking to him. So this loudly proclaimed message as though coming from a trumpet. I don't know if you've ever played in the orchestra and had to sit in front of the trumpets, but you can perhaps relate to the nearness and dearness of that sound. But instruments with bells like that have a way of projecting extremely well when you're very near. This picture, this sound of the trumpet of God.
Keith?
Yes.
Would this have been, so there were great occasions, special occasions when they sounded trumpets, but it seems like they also would have had a lot of minor occasions. That was a way of just signaling. Would it be similar then to, you know, not so far back, bells were used to notify the community of different, you know, there were special occasions, and then there were just ordinary, you know, daily things that the bells would ring for as well?
Yeah, I haven't looked at the evidence of how often they used trumpets. Certainly it was an alarming call, maybe more like our sirens. You know, we can relate to that. The trumpet often is referred to in connection with battle. So those kind of events, but it may well have been used more often than that. I don't...
Like, you know, a call to prayer type situation.
Perhaps. Like I say, I can't speak to that.
Well, in Numbers 10, it talks about the silver trumpets that were cast. That you make yourself two silver trumpets of silver of hammered work, and you shall make them, and you shall use them for summoning the congregation and for having the camp set out. When both are blown, all the congregation shall gather themselves to you at the doorway of your tent of meeting. Yet if only one is blown, then the leaders, the heads of the divisions of Israel, shall assemble before you. And it goes on to talk about alarms, the side of the temple or the tabernacle set out, and the next one, the next one.
But, you know, it's an instrument which can project a long ways. It gets everybody's attention. And as long as you know what the sound of the trumpet means, Paul talks about if the trumpet sound an uncertain sound, what are the people supposed to do? But as long as it's an understood signal, then it's a way of communicating over large distances whenever you don't have all the modern things we got now, which sometimes work. Yes. So, yes, the great trumpet certainly brings images to mind.
One other thing, too. The beginning of the chapter and the end of the chapter having, you know, the bookends in that day, and then repeats. Reminds me of what you shared with us Wednesday night. They like that form.
Yes.
Or at least there are several instances, a couple of examples here that they like the mirror image. I forget what the official name of it is.
Chiastic, I think, is. Yeah. And it occurs a lot in the literature of the Old Testament. Okay. So, chapter 27, then, is actually the last chapter of one of the subsections that we have looked at as part of the outline of this book. And just to remind you of how that looks, Isaiah 1 through 37, Alec Moitcher designates the Book of the King, with the subsection 13 through 27 as being under the heading of the Universal Kingdom. And so we've just seen the sense of that, in that Isaiah speaks of this trumpet calling those from beyond the borders of Israel. And so now we're ready to start into the section 28 through 37, where there is an emphasis on God as the Lord of history. And certainly he's been shown as the Lord throughout this, but perhaps a more focused view in these chapters. From the vision of divine purposes in chapters 13 through 27, Isaiah turns to the reality of divine power. So purposes to power. It is the task of chapters 28 through 37 to demonstrate that the Lord does actually rule world history, and that therefore his as yet unfulfilled promises and purposes are sure. At two climactic points in chapters 13 through 27, namely in 19 and 27, Isaiah predicted the gathering of Egypt and Assyria into full membership of the Lord's people. The first and the contemporary oppressive superpower. So the first superpower that Israel encountered was Egypt, and God delivered them from them. And in Isaiah's day, Egypt wasn't nearly as significant a power in the world as Assyria. And so that's why the designation, the first and contemporary oppressive superpowers, would alike come under the sway of the Lord as king. To Isaiah's contemporaries, this must have seemed both marvelous and unlikely, that aliens should become members, inveterate enemies, friends, and imperial powers quietly submissive. Isaiah therefore offers the greatest of his interim fulfillments, a period of history in which divine sovereignty over Judah, Egypt, and Assyria would be demonstrated before their very eyes. As far as the three nations were concerned, each would be determined on its own way, but the outcome would be what the Lord willed, and that by direct divine action. As we shall see, the occasion is that of the Egyptian alliance in the days of Hezekiah. Judah is seen willfully refusing the way of trust in the Lord for trust in Egypt. Egypt is revealed as blustering and ultimately ineffective, and the Assyrian army, bending its colossal power to punish the rebels, is destroyed by the angel of the Lord. In the first section, chapters 28 and 29, though the material is woven around the episode of Egyptian alliance, neither Egypt nor Assyria is named. And Isaiah's purpose is to elucidate the principles involved in the situation and in the Lord's dealings with his people. Then in chapters 30, 32, Isaiah comes to grips with Egypt and Assyria by name, but the more plainly he engages with history, the more easily he moves into eschatology, or the end times, placing the messianic kingdom side by side with the downfall of Assyria. In chapters 33 through 35, the acts of God in history become the pattern of his end time acts. And in chapters 36, 37, the firm rock of history is offered as a secure foundation for the hopes just outlined. It is as if Isaiah were saying, "See what he has done. Now trust him. For he will yet do all he has promised." And so even though Isaiah doesn't use the word as many times as Jesus does in the New Testament, we see this continuity of message here with regard to our relationship to God. Just trust him. It's the message of Isaiah. It's the message of Jesus. It's the message of Paul. It's the message of Christianity. Though the section can be thematically outlined like this, chapters 28 through 35 have their own six-part unity, marked by the recurrence of the word woe. So another six woes. You may remember there were six woes earlier in Isaiah that I counted as seven, but it was only six, and once again six. The presentation is balanced between the first three woes offering principles of divine action, and the second three giving matching applications to history and eschatology, or end time things. Okay, so there's a little bit of a preview slash outline of what's coming in this next section of Isaiah. And so let's take a look at the text of chapter 28. Okay. Hang on just a second. All my scroll bars disappeared. I need to do some homework on how to manage this thing.
Keith, if you hit that minimize button, does that get it completely out of your way? The top left corner?
That's for my Bible works.
No, the...
left corner.
Yeah, up there at the top left corner, that dash, go left, right there. What does that do? There you go.
It makes it go away. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Now, what's this over here? Okay. Chapter 28. Woe to the crown of pride, to the drunkards of Ephraim, whose glorious beauty is a fading flower, which are on the head of the fat valleys of them that are overcome with wine. Okay, so you'll find that throughout Isaiah, there's not this continuous timeline where you start and go and go and go and go. But we have repeated offerings of images that refer to things that are occurring in his past, in his present, and into the future. And so we are once again revisiting the condition slash fate of the northern kingdom. Ephraim, you remember, is often used to refer to the 10 tribes to the north, which were ruled from Samaria. But the tribe of Ephraim was a dominant force in that kingdom, and so it's often used to refer to that kingdom. And you'll probably also remember that the northern kingdom was taken captive, taken into exile by the Assyrians before, a century and a half almost before, Jerusalem was taken by the Babylonians. In fact, about 722 is whenever the northern kingdom was captured. But he's still talking about it as though it's about to happen in this particular passage. He pictures Samaria as a terraced vineyards. You can imagine the terraces following the valley sides around. And them, in particular, he pictures them as being in the last stages of a party. And their glorious beauty, he says, is as a fading flower. Isaiah is very observant of the world around him and uses all sorts of metaphors to communicate. So surely you can connect with that image. Nothing quite as beautiful as a fresh flower, as a just bloomed flower. Nothing quite so sad as one which is a little past its stages, right? It's going downhill. It's not coming back. It's soon to be gone. And so he says of the northern kingdom, woe to them. They are oblivious to the reality that is about to swallow them. They're under the influence of another substance. Behold, the Lord hath a mighty and strong one, which as a tempest of hail and a destroying storm, as a flood of mighty waters overflowing, shall cast down to the earth with the hand. The crown of pride, the drunkards of Ephraim, shall be trodden underfoot. And the glorious beauty which is on the head of the fat valley shall be a fading flower. And as the hasty fruit before the summer, which when he that looketh upon it seeth, while it is yet in his hand, he eateth it up. Okay, so this speaks of the first ripe figs of summer, which I've never had this experience in terms of figs, but perhaps blackberries. You're walking down the path and you see the first ripe blackberry, and how long does it last, right? It goes in the mouth and it's gone. So that's another strong metaphor which you could relate to if you lived in this part of the world and experienced these kind of things. the first ripe fig down the hatch. That's how long it lasts.
So, Keith.
Yes.
Yesterday I posted a picture on Facebook of the cherry trees out back, just blooming and beautiful. Left, I finished mowing, left, went back to the coffee shop, just got home, I had to run back home to get some stuff. And it was really, really windy.
Uh-huh.
And the wind, I guess a big gust of wind came and just broke and twisted the biggest cherry tree and just, it's gone.
Wow.
Just taking the pictures how beautiful it was. And full in bloom, and it's laying on the ground, twisted and broken.
So this this destroying storm you can relate to, right? Yes. It was incredibly windy yesterday.
It's
yeah.
So fascinating. You know, you probably all feel that, just that, I don't know, it's a thrill when you have a beautiful day like yesterday and you see God's creation in its glory. And yet, you know, just on the other side of tomorrow, it's totally going to be gone. And it just makes you, it reminds me how we crave for fulfillment, and it's never there. It's never, you know, but He is where we want to take our minds, even in all of that glory, if I can remember. I always tell myself, well, think about who made it, not it.
Right.
That's where the deep lasts.
Enjoy the moment, because it's passing, yes. Look at it as a preview, right, of something eternal, something that is not going to leave.
I think you enjoy actually that glory more than trying to pull out of it what it can't give you. That's fascinating.
So he says, "This party's over. The Lord has a force which is going to bring about its end. In that day shall the Lord of hosts be for a crown of glory and for a diadem of beauty unto the residue of his people, and for a spirit of judgment to him that setteth in judgment, and for strength to them that turn the battle to the gate." This message of a remnant, of a residue, we see throughout Isaiah. In spite of the judgment, in spite of the dire predictions of destruction, it's not a destruction to oblivion, but there is a remnant, there is a residue that God will bring about and bring back. And so he says, to the residue, it's the Lord of hosts who is the crown of glory, the diadem of beauty. And he goes on here, and the "they" here is not to be understood as a direct reference to the residue or even to the drunkards of Ephraim, but seems to be a change in focus now to Jerusalem and the likely occurrence of celebration that occurred relative to this agreement with Egypt. So during the time of Hezekiah, there was sort of a treaty made with Egypt to stand against the Assyrians. And Isaiah was totally against it. I saw it as a refusal to trust in God and a design to try to find security in diplomacy and in earthly affiliations and alliances. And so he of course was looked at by his contemporaries as being woefully simplistic. What do you mean just trust in God? You know, times are more complicated than that. We live in a sophisticated world. There has to be this working about of alliances to bring about security. So, with that in mind, think about these words. But they also have erred through wine and through strong drink, are out of the way. I didn't read that quite right, but I think you got it. The priest and the prophet have erred through strong drink. They are swallowed up of wine. They're out of the way through strong drink. They err in vision. They stumble in judgment. For all tables are full of vomit and filthiness, so that there is no place clean. Who shall he teach knowledge, and whom shall he make to understand doctrine? Them that are weaned from the milk and drawn from the breasts. So it appears as though Isaiah was likened in his simplicity to teaching kindergartners, so to speak. They're very young. And so this expression, for precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little and there a little. For with stammering lips and another tongue will he speak to this people. Okay, and so I don't know what comes to your mind there, but I'm hearing also book after book, right? But this sort of this repetition that occurs whenever you teach the young, they may hear, they may understand the first time, but it doesn't usually stick, does it? You've got to repeat it and make it a part of their conscience and their consciousness, precept upon precept, line upon line. To whom he saith, this is the rest wherewith ye shall cause the weary to rest, and this is the refreshing, yet they would not hear. Okay, so Isaiah would say, trust in the Lord. This is where you should rest. This is where you should put your security. But they would not hear. But the word of the Lord was unto them precept upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little, there a little, that they might go and fall backward and be broken and snared and taken. Wherefore, Isaiah says, hear the word of the Lord, ye scornful men that rule this people which is in Jerusalem. And so you see there the justification for understanding a change in people that he's talking about here. You had to read a little farther to see it, but he's changed to talking about Jerusalem. Because ye have said, we have made a covenant with death, and with hell are we at agreement. When the overflowing scourge shall pass through, it shall not come unto us. For we have made lies our refuge, and under falsehood have we hid ourselves. Okay, so he is editorializing what they would say. They, of course, wouldn't feel like they were basing this on lies and falsehood, but that's his assessment of what they've done in entering into this alliance with Egypt. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. He that believeth shall not make haste. Now, I suppose that, like me, whenever you read that, you start having some lights come on in the back of your brain, right? I've heard those words before. Where have I heard those words before? I've read those in another place. Well, they are in a number of places. In 1 Peter 2:6, Peter says, "For this is contained in Scripture. Behold, I lay in Zion a choice stone, a precious cornerstone. And he who believes in him shall not be disappointed." So that's clearly a direct quote from Isaiah chapter 28. Paul in Romans 9 says, "Just as it is written, behold, I lay in Zion a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. And he who believes in him will not be disappointed." Now, Paul seems to have combined a couple passages because you notice here in Isaiah, the stone is not referred to as a stone of stumbling. It's referred to as a foundation, as a precious cornerstone, but not as a stone of stumbling. However, in Psalms 118, we have not the stone of stumbling, but another reference to a stone. The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone.
What does that mean, shall not make haste? You that believe it shall not make haste.
So the metaphor there is... if you're making haste, if you're hurrying, the picture is that of running in disarray, of not having a foundation because of what's about to overcome you. Notice that Peter translates it as will not be disappointed. He that trusts in him shall not be disappointed. Sometimes you see connected with that language the concept of being ashamed, shall not be ashamed. And those all speak of a lack of satisfaction, a lack of success of whatever the issue is. So, yeah. And if you think about a foundation, that's not what you want in a foundation, right? You want something which is sure, which you don't have to run from or because of, but which you can stand by and be protected. So then Jesus in Matthew 21 says, did you ever read in the Scriptures, the stone which the builders rejected became the chief cornerstone? This came about from the Lord, and it is marvelous in our eyes. So that combines Psalms, the concept of the stone which the builders rejected, with the chief cornerstone. Isaiah is it's a precious cornerstone. And then Paul in Romans 10 just quotes the part, whoever believes in him will not be disappointed. Let's take a look right quick at some other translations of the verse in Isaiah about the make haste. ESV says, will not be in haste. The Septuagint says, shall not be ashamed. NAS translates it, he who believes in it will not be disturbed. And Complete Jewish Bible says, he who trusts will not rush here and there. Okay. So those are all ways of communicating a security which will be a part of believing in this foundation.
It's kind of the opposite.
So, I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's kind of the opposite of trust. He who trusts won't be stressed, or he who trusts won't be wound up.
It's the picture of somebody who doesn't have anything to trust, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. When you're stressed out inside, you feel At least I do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're rushing inside. Your heart is rushing. Everything's rushing. It's, you know, sometimes I just have to be like, why do I feel in a hurry right now? There's mm-hmm. nothing to hurry about. And I realize I'm probably stressing about something I didn't even realize. And to just calm it all down.
Yeah. Yeah, or like Rachel used to say, let's hurry so we don't have to rush. That's not the same thing. That's I think she and Dan's mom shared that saying. So it's a must be a North Carolina thing. I don't know. Okay, so this precious cornerstone. But here again, it's interesting to note that there's no quite often when we think about prophecy, okay, Isaiah's a prophet, and we sort of get locked into, okay, we're going to find out what's going to happen and when. But it's not that way, right? The Lord's going to do this. I lay a foundation, but you would never guess from Isaiah that he's talking about the Messiah at that point. It's a saying which is in response to the lack of trust of the men of the day of Isaiah, and yet we see how that in the New Testament this is understood to be a reference to what God did through Jesus. And so interesting how that all works. So Isaiah says, judgment. And remember, justice and judgment are usually being communicated through that word. Also will I lay to the lion, and righteousness to the plummet. Okay, so plumb line. How many of you have ever used a plumb bob? Some of you? You know what a plumb bob is? If you need a way to find a vertical line sometime in your life, you use a plumb bob. If, for instance, you want to know what spot is directly below some spot on the ceiling, you use a plumb bob. A plumb bob is just a string with a weight on the end of it. Usually it's pointed so you can get a specific spot. But it is a means of, it's a reality check. Okay? Because it always points to the center of the gravity of the earth. Now, that, of course, means that no two vertical lines are actually parallel, because if I find a vertical over here and a vertical over here, they actually are both slightly out of parallel. But it is an absolute reference. It's often used in Scripture in that sense, that this is a way of checking, how am I doing? And also just a string. In general, if you need a straight line, you take a string and you stretch it between two points, and you have a reference. If you're doing building, if you're building a brick wall, there's nothing quite so unhappy as laying a row of bricks and looking down them and saying, oh, they move in and out a little bit. And so bricklayers, in order to prevent that from happening, they'll stretch a string. As long as they're faithful to that string, they end up with a straight wall. I have been working on making a table that is fairly long and made of boards that have a live edge, so there's no straight lines to go by. And I wasn't wanting to build a U-table. I wanted it to be kind of straight. And so I used a string to, as a reference, and you still had to kind of work with the wandering edge, but that was the means I used to make sure it ended up fairly straight. So we find in the prophets this reference to strings and plumb lines as reality checks. God's going to, lost my place here. What verse am I on?
17.
There it is, the line, the plummet. Thank you. And the hail, he says, shall sweep away the refuge of lies, and the water shall overflow the hiding place. So these are often symbolically forces of divine judgment. There's no nation in control of the weather, in spite of articles you may have read online. God is the one who controls those things. And it's the forces, divine forces, which bring about this reality check. Your covenant with death shall be disannulled, and your agreement with hell shall not stand. When the overflowing scourge shall pass through, then ye shall be trodden down by it. Okay, so this mass of Assyrians coming in from the north are going to obliterate this treaty that you have with Egypt. Now, the Assyrians didn't take away Jerusalem itself. They took away a lot of the surrounding towns. Jerusalem stood until the Babylonians besieged it. But at any rate, the plan that they had for their perseverance or their survival is not what saved them. It was God who saved them from the Assyrians. The Assyrians were at the point of besieging Jerusalem, and God delivered them that time. At any rate, their well thought out plans didn't work. From the time that it goeth forth, it shall take you. For morning by morning shall it pass over, by day and by night, and it shall be a vexation only to understand the report. For the bed is shorter than that a man can stretch himself on it, and the covering narrower than he can wrap himself in it. Okay, so I don't know if you've ever had some really exciting camping experiences, but that tends to be where you encounter things like this, beds that aren't long enough. And then the picture here, he says, it's too long, right? So what do you want to do? You want to curl up, right? You want to bring your feet up, and then the blanket won't cover you. So this is a miserable situation. No two ways about it. And it's another one of Isaiah's memorable metaphors for describing the calamities of not trusting in the Lord and tending to your own devices. Well, the bell has rung and the lights have come up, and I will be quiet. Thank you all. Thank you.
I should have not tried this morning. But I've got a song in my heart, so I'm going to try it.
Unfailing love flows from his heart and heals my soul. In spite
failing.